Hello, a 7-day break from us, but we are back. I on the Liga Marca's football podcast is up and running here to give you all the news and reaction to the big stories from the last 7 days in Spanish football and a look ahead at what's on the horizon with all things La Liga. Coming up on the show today, we're looking at the international break that's coming up ominously this weekend as Spain gets set to take on Italy. We'll take a brief look back at the Champions League from last week, and of course there was a massive weekend of La Liga games to get through, and we're going to be looking at all the major stories and fallout from that. Joining myself, Ollie Wilson, on the show today are two fine footballing minds indeed from Marca. Firstly, Jason Pettigrove, our editor and writer for Marca in English. Jason, pleasure to chat with you as always, mate. Quite the week that we've been having. I suppose you get a little bit of a break and a bit of a slowdown in the next day or so with the international break coming up.
A small rest, but we do like to be kept busy as well, you know, so we've got lots to talk about in the pod this week. A lot of exciting La Liga action over the past weekend. Looking forward to it. Thanks for having me on as always.
And the other guest on the show today joining us is regular voice Mark Mayo, writer for Marca in English. Mark, Jason said that there's no rest for the wicked. There was no rest last week, of course, with all the European football and everything like that. You must be run down and probably looking forward to this international break slightly after the action-packed weekend we've just had.
Yeah, it's a real long slog that you get into at this part of the season with sort of winter is coming in a large respect, because you know you're going to get a game every 3 days and it just sort of kills you in a way. But no, the international break is nice because certain teams don't want to play domestic football at the moment. It's certain teams would love to play every 3 days, like they're winning and they want to keep going. So the momentum aspect of it is quite interesting, especially for us as well. And it sort of puts a lot more emphasis on the games that we've just had in the last few days.
Let's kick things off with a look back at the Champions League then. Jason, we had plenty to get our teeth into last week. Of course, Real Madrid with a 2-2 draw against Dortmund. Sevilla continuing their impressive start in Europe, getting a 1-0 win against Lyon. Borussia Mönchengladbach made it very difficult for Barcelona on Wednesday night, and Atletico Madrid with their 1-0 win against Bayern Munich. Just quickly, what caught your eye with the Champions League action? The Real Madrid game was thrilling till the end, with Los Blancos throwing away a lead twice.
It was, but I actually would prefer to talk about how Borussia Mönchengladbach pinned back Barcelona for quite a long time in their game. I think everybody expected Barcelona to come out and win the game quite easily. Mönchengladbach had lost quite heavily in their first game, of course. But they did. They almost out Barcelona. They came out, pressed very high. They had some very willing runners up front. Thorgan Hazard, Eden's younger brother, Rafael, were just on top of the defence the whole time. Really knocked sort of Barcelona out of their stride. And it took a real gutsy comeback with Gerard Piqué and Arda Turan playing particularly well to get Barcelona what was in the end a very, very good result.
Yeah, Turan with an excellent game. I'm sure he was very pleased to be on the score sheet in the Champions League, and always pleased to make a positive impact after he had so many critics of his performances last season after joining from Atletico Madrid. Didn't it start impressively at the Camp Nou, but with a big goal in midweek, and Piqué as well popping up. He'll be popping up a couple of times, actually, I think, in this show, because he had a big impact as well on the weekend for Barcelona. Mark, how about yourself then? Jason's covered the Barcelona aspect. What, aside from the side from the Camp Nou in the Champions League, kind of caught your eye? I mentioned Sevilla, of course, with a decent victory against Lyon, and that thriller between Dortmund and Real Madrid.
Yeah, it's interesting watching the games this week, because you kind of got a sense that the draw, when it was made, that there were two teams against each other fighting for the top and two teams sort of below that. And even though I think Man City drew and Barcelona struggled, you look at these, it kind of still fits into my idea that the top two are going to walk away in a sense. And then looking ahead to the knockout rounds, it kind of makes who wins the group redundant, because you're either going to be playing an Atletico or a Bayern Munich, a Man City or a Barcelona. So whoever wins those battles in the group themselves kind of is redundant in a sense, because by the time you get to the last 16, everyone's going to be piled in together, bar a few upsets. And it's going to be an interesting one to see how that pans out. But the group stage at the moment, as I think, it is kind of on hold, the Champions League, as to where we can really look to a top team.
I'm sure there were some teams that not so long ago would have looked at Atleti and Bayern Munich in the same group and gone, oh, we'd much rather face Atletico Madrid in the knockout stages rather than Bayern. Let's make sure we win our group and avoid that. Now, I don't think anybody wants to face either of those two teams, and Atletico was superb against Bayern Munich in midweek as well. It was not quite the same for Real Madrid in Germany against Dortmund, but it's always some fantastic ties in the group stages when you've got two of the big sides together, and in theory, that should filter out into the knockout stages as well. We're going to take a very quick break on the show. Of course, we're going to dive into this action-packed weekend of La Liga football, and that's what we're going to get our teeth into for the majority of the podcast today. Europe has pretty much been covered in the last week or so, but this weekend, oh boy, there is so much to talk about. We'll be right back in a moment here on Eye on La Liga. Yes, welcome back to Eye on La Liga. Of course, we continue to bring you all of the breakdown from Spain's top flight. And last weekend, an incredible weekend of results. Now Atletico Madrid, top of the league. We'll be getting into them and into Real Madrid's fortunes from the weekend in just a moment. But Jason, I kind of want to start with you. I know you were keeping particular attention on Barcelona's trip to Celta Vigo. An incredible turn up for the books. I don't think many predicted Celta to get a victory in this one. Barca 3-0 down after 33 minutes. It's not very often we say that as well. Your thoughts on the matchup between Luis Enrique and his former club, and the fact that Luis Enrique can't beat this Celta Vigo side still?
Yeah, I think, as you know, a lot of people are saying it was Barcelona off colour, but that kind of takes away from, you know, giving Celta the credit they deserve. That's the third time now that they've beaten Barcelona since Enrique has been the coach. Once at Camp Nou, twice now at Balaidos, and in both games at Balaidos they've scored 4 goals. And in both of those games, they were the better team. They pressed high. Again, a bit like, as I said earlier on with Mönchengladbach, they really got into Barcelona from the off. But perhaps the first 10 minutes, you know, Barca were knocking the ball about. But as soon as that first goal went in from Pirni Sisto, it was just a collapse. I mean, we don't often see that. Sergio Busquets particularly was off colour, you know, getting caught up in possession quite a bit in the middle of the park. Jeremy Mathieu at the back is complete liability, and I don't really understand. I know there has to be rotation from, you know, the coaches of the top teams, but that one baffled me a bit. I'm not sure, and I've certainly not heard that Javier Mascherano had an injury, so I don't know why he didn't start. And of course, when Mathieu scored his own goal to make it 3-0, I mean, it was catastrophic at that point. I think we saw that.
If you've got doubts about him playing, then you're going to have even more when he finds the back of his own net, aren't you?
Yeah, indeed. And I mean, I think then we saw, really, when Iniesta came on at half time, we saw a different Barcelona. Pique, as we mentioned, as an auxiliary striker, sort of really coming up trumps. And apart from, you know, Ter Stegen's awful, awful mistake late in the game, we could have seen a very, very unlikely draw. But, you know, as we said, Ter Stegen's been compared to Garrincha by Michael Robinson, who's now quite an esteemed pundit in Spain. And Ter Stegen has got a bit of a habit of making errors in his judgments. He can be very good with his distribution and, you know, with his hands, but, you know, every so often he comes up with a clanger. I mean, there's quite a few that we've actually got on marker.com/EN if people want to go and take a look. And there's probably 6 or 7 there, and they're real howlers.
I'm sure he'll love you for that, putting up the Ter Stegen's best, worst moments of his career so far. The one against Celta Vigo from the weekend will certainly be included in that, I'm sure. I mean, it's disastrous, but if Barca are going to play out from the back, the great thing that's always been with these Barca keepers is that generally, although they play out from the back, they don't play silly beggars out from the back. Whereas Ter Stegen, particularly with this incident on the weekend, just likes to be a little bit too fancy at times. It needs and requires Luis Enrique and other players around him as well to really hammer into him to ball security at the end of the day, because there, it wasn't like that was the easiest option either to try and dink the ball away like that. He had two options he could go for, even with Celta playing that high press, and he opted instead to try and be a little too cheeky and a little too rambunctious with it. And he's paid a massive price, and it's cost Barca any chance of getting anything out of that game.
Yeah, I think you've really summed up quite well yourself there. But I mean, playing the ball back to Alba when all he needed to do was open his body up, look the other way, and I think he had Sergio Roberto was in acres of space. Barcelona, they like to keep things simple, so Ter Stegen has to do exactly that, keeping it simple, no sort of dallying around in the box. Barcelona like their keepers to play with their feet, you know, and also in terms of the ball coming out from the back, you very, very rarely see Barcelona thumping it long. And so that's the way they've always played. That's the way they continue to play. But when you've got a situation like that, I mean, there was really, really no need for him to even have any time on the ball. He just needed to have one touch, get it back out again. And unfortunately for him and for Barcelona, they paid the ultimate price and obviously lost the chance of being on top come the end of the weekend.
A ludicrous error of judgment from the goalkeeper. What about the error of Luis Enrique? Is he at fault at all for any of this? He's obviously got Celta have got the hoodoo over him slightly. But not only that, you mentioned earlier that this high press is starting to catch out Barcelona. Whereas, I know you shouldn't make comparisons between managers, particularly Enrique and someone like Pep Guardiola, but Guardiola's Barca side never was caught out by a high press, even when teams did try to play that. Everybody tried sitting off. Others tried playing Barca at their own game, trying to hustle and harry them. No one could ever find a weak link and ever really break down this Barca side to an extent, and they never really paid a price for that. Whereas Luis Enrique, at times now, you're seeing teams play this high press, be a bit more rambunctious and I guess enthusiastic in their ability and their determination to shut down Barca high up the pitch. And it's working, but why is it working when other managers at Barcelona haven't been caught out by this sort of thing?
Well, I think Pep Guardiola's Barca was a one-off. I mean, sort of that period from 2008 to 2012, and particularly around about 2011. I mean, as you rightly said, there wasn't really a team that could get near them. They'd pass teams off the park. But I think what you have to look at from that point of view, that moment in time, it was, you know, Xavi in his pomp, Lionel Messi in his sort of Ballon d'Or pomp, if I can put it like that, you know, every player playing at an extremely high level week in and week out, and also playing in exactly the same way. There was very rarely, if ever, any deviation from the tactics. And I think what you've got now with Enrique, and I do credit him to a certain extent, he tries to change things up a bit and he's trying to bring different styles into play. But also on the back of that, you're then getting teams that are now, you know, beginning to work out that actually, if you do force the issue with Barcelona, if you do get into them quickly from the first whistle, they're just as vulnerable as other teams. And you can't keep relying on the likes of Messi, Neymar and Suarez to keep getting them out of trouble. It's a silly way of sort of going about your business. Well, you score four, we'll score five, because that's not always going to happen.
Right, it seems like we're almost repeating ourselves from last season when there was the lack of rotation and you can't rely on a Messi, Suarez and Neymar combo to get you out of jail every time, and especially when they're starting to get tired. And if Barca do continue to do that, you're just going to get the same thing happening again with tired legs at the end of the campaign for those main three. Quickly, before we move on to Atletico with Mark, I do want to touch on just Celta Vigo, how we've got to give them some credit for this victory. I mean, an 11-minute battering of Barcelona suddenly went from 0-0 to 3-0 between the 22nd and 33rd minutes. Sisto and Aspas, particularly, I know, Jason, you were quite impressed with in that time period and generally throughout the game.
Yeah, I mean, looking at that time period particularly, if people were to watch that back and watch how many times Barca lost the ball in the middle of the park, which enabled Celta to then sort of catch Barca on the back foot, it'd be quite remarkable. But, I mean, all over the pitch, we had, I think, Wass had a great game. Hugo Mayo kept Neymar quiet for quite a long period, and those two have got a bit of history, so I wasn't surprised to see, you know, a bit more sort of stuff going on the side with those two. Right the way, I mean, Burrito has obviously got them drilled. He knows how to play against Barcelona. He knows how to pull their strings and, you know, what sort of gets underneath their skin. And I give them full credit for, you know, again, I mean, how many times do teams score four goals against Barcelona? And they've done it twice now in the space of 12 months.
Would you say, though, perhaps it was only two goals against Barcelona with Mateo's own goal and Ter Stegen's mishap? OK, Mark, I want to touch on the Atletico Madrid game against Valencia from the weekend. We've done and dusted with Barca, but Atleti, excellent victory. Still can't get it done from the penalty spot, though. Is that going to be any sort of worry for Simeone? Another two penalties missed in this game against Valencia. Of course, Griezmann is really struggling from the penalty spot. Remember the Champions League final. He's already missed two, maybe even three, off the top of my head, this season from 12 yards. It's about the only fault that I can find in the way that Atletico are playing at the moment, just that ability to finish from a penalty spot. Everything else, defensively, they're fantastic. They've only conceded two this season so far. It's all going right for them.
Yeah, it's really strange that they don't have this ability to finish off penalties, because you think about them as a really clinical team that are sort of dispatch teams rather professionally, and yet not only did we see Griezmann miss on the weekend, but we saw Gabby miss one as well. So it's a strange situation to find themselves in. At the same point, you've got to praise Diego Alves, because I don't think there's a goalkeeper in the world at the moment who's more adept at saving penalties. And it's kind of a joke on Valencia as well, because they were going to sell the man in the summer. So it's interesting to see how that unfolded in their favour in the end. But for Atletico, you're looking at players who previously you would look at them and think, oh, they're Koke, Saul, Stefan Savic even, Juanfran, Felipe Luis. These are good players that you can trust and that you can make a good team out of, and that's what Atletico have done. But I think if they're going to go on and continue this form, then you're looking at them as world-class players, in effect, because they've done it for so long and they've done it so well that this Atletico team continue to be underestimated in certain ways.
Let's touch on Diego Alves. You mentioned him just a moment ago. This incredible penalty-saving record that he's got. I think it's 19 in 41 now. Almost 50% of the penalties he's faced have been saved recently. I mean, what is the difference between Diego Alves' approach to other goalkeepers? Is it he's just lucky? He puts in that film study in the week, knows exactly where players tend to go. I mean, we always used to say somebody like Frank Lampard always goes down the middle, and keepers would still know that and still go left or right, thinking now was the time was going to psych them out. Or is it that he's just patient? He waits to see where the ball is going and just has the reactions to be able to then still get across, read it and react in time.
We were talking about this off air, actually, that it's difficult to really know how a goalkeeper goes about his work in a penalty, because you can never really know how much he studies, because that's behind the scenes, etc. So to watch him before a penalty, you do notice there is that patience, and he doesn't dive. And a lot of goalkeepers these days and a lot of penalty takers rely on going early, having their studying done and thinking he'll definitely go right. And players have started working it out and thinking they'll slow their run up. I don't know if Simone Zaza was thinking about that at the Euros, but you slow your run up and then theoretically you place it where the goalkeeper isn't. But Diego Alves doesn't really allow that to happen, which is quite an interesting point of view to take in an era where you think the preparation is so high. He does kind of leave it on the day, and it works.
It's the goalkeepers that make those reaction saves, to me, are always the ones that are the most impressive, and Diego Alves now taking that to the penalty spot. I think that also sums up almost this whole Valencia side, an ethos at the club at this point, the fact that they were going to sell him perhaps at the beginning of this season, and he's having a cracking start to the campaign when perhaps others around him aren't helping, but Valencia just don't know which way they're turning still, left, right or centre, and what's really going on there. Staying on Atletico Madrid, though, let's touch on Griezmann, top scorer at the moment, 6 goals in La Liga. He's had an incredible start to the season after the two dodgy games. It was almost his comments that seemed to reignite and reinvigorate this side before the last international break. And he's a player who's playing at the top of his game. He took France kicking and screaming almost at times to the Euros and to the final of the Euros, of course, in the summer. Had an amazing season last year, helped guide Atletico Madrid to a Champions League final. Could have got the winner were it not for his disappointing form in front of goal from the penalty spot. surely, though, this start to the season, the way he's reacted, puts him right up there in that Ballon d'Or question and gives us a viable third option, as opposed to it's Ronaldo or Messi and then the third person is just somebody to make up the places. Do you not think Griezmann is arguably a standout candidate for the Ballon d'Or, because memories are short in football, and with Messi injured, Ronaldo's only just come back from injury and has struggled in the start of this La Liga campaign, it's Griezmann that really, in 2016, has the best block of work throughout the year so far.
You're absolutely right that there is always a recency bias that comes into these things. You definitely want your best form to be around October, November, when everyone's thinking about these awards. But the way the Ballon d'Or sort of unfolds, you've got, you know, captains and managers from all over the world. All their votes count the same, and there's so much tactical voting. At the end of the day, it does fold up or unfold as a sort of popularity contest. And the problem that Griezmann will face is that while he's been great this year, he's only just come on the scene in large effect. Whereas Messi has people who are going to vote for him no matter what. Ronaldo, just likewise, he has so many adoring fans over the world that spills over into the Ballon d'Or vote as well. And the problem that I think Griezmann's going to find is that those two finals that he lost were against Ronaldo, which Ronaldo then won. And rightly or wrongly, that's going to have a big effect.
Yeah, that's always the interesting one, whether it's an individual award or if the fact that those team trophies really do make the difference. And if you're going on that, you arguably point towards Cristiano Ronaldo, even though the biggest role he played in the European Championships final in the summer was almost that manager role that he had on the sideline. And even that knee injury wasn't going to affect him and stop him from cheering his side on and bouncing around on the touchline trying to reinvigorate the team. But Griezmann was doing it on the pitch, just couldn't do enough, of course, in that final, and has stumbled in finals, as I say. What about Atletico then, in terms of the grander scheme of things? And of course, you look at their body of work since the last international break: 4-0 against Celta Vigo, 1-0 against PSV in the Champions League, 5-0 against Sporting Gijón, the 1-1 draw away at Barcelona, 1-0 against Deportivo, 1-0, as I say, against Bayern Munich, and this 2-0 victory against Valencia on the weekend. It's a marked change from the very slow start that we saw against Alaves and Leganes. They're not conceding at all. Only Barcelona putting a goal past them in September in 6 games, and 7 if you include that Valencia result at the weekend. It's a side that's playing the best football in the Liga, arguably, and really the international break comes at the worst time for Simeone's team.
It kind of does. At the same point, they had this before. They had the last international break, about 17 players went away, and they always have that same little four group of players: Juanfran, Thiago, Gabi and Fernando Torres, the veterans, if you like, always left behind to work on their own. I don't know how much work they can get done in that scenario. Maybe they just go and play the PlayStation or something. But it's a bad time and also a good time, because they haven't been on top yet, and now they are, and they can sit there for the next fortnight knowing they're on top. I would have to mention that, kind of silently, I made the prediction that they were going to win La Liga before the season. It's important that I get that out there early before it is, you know, marked in stone that they've won it. So I do think they have what it takes. And effectively, you look at a side that is so used to losing their players and is so used to having to manage these things every season, that this year they've made that marked step up, and they've really shown that they are going to keep older players. They've got Griezmann to a new contract. They've got several other players to a new contract. This is the year that they make that step up from being the one below Real Madrid in Barcelona to the one alongside them.
Yeah, I always make that prediction silently for the Grand National and for the Super Bowl winners and every major European.
It's when the bookies say, but you didn't actually place the bet. But I said, no, I did place the bet, just not with you.
Yeah. No, I bet against myself. That's what I do. Every time I make one of those predictions, I'm betting against myself. And I always end up winning somehow. That's how I said Leicester would win at the start of last season as well with the Premier League. But nobody heard me, because I just kept it internal. I know what you're saying there, Mark.
It's more important that way, I think.
Yeah. Maybe next time, say that on the first show of the season rather than just as Atletico Madrid go top. We're going to take a very quick break here on the show. When we come back, we're going to be looking at Eibar and Los Blancos when we return here on Eye on La Liga. Yeah,
Yes, welcome back to Eye on La Liga. We are continuing to look back on the events from the weekend, and we're going to dive straight into a little bit of Real Madrid action. Los Blancos held at the Bernabeu by Eibar, of all people. A very unexpected result indeed, even with Zidane's side struggling at the moment. I'm delighted to say, joining us in this part of the show to talk all about Eibar and their rise to the La Liga infamy, if you will, with this draw on the weekend, is Ewan McTare, writer of Eibar the Brave. Ewan, pleasure to have you on
the show,
mate.
Thanks for having me on.
How are
you today?
I'm very, very pleased to have you on indeed. It's always good to get a little bit of discussion about some of the... I don't want to be too rude here and too dismissive of Eibar, but the lesser side
that's fair.
La Liga. Ewan, I've got to ask though, why Eibar? Why go and write a book about one of these sorts of sides in Spanish football? It's been an interesting rise for sure, but it's not one that a lot of people would immediately draw their attention.
No, you're quite right. It's, the thing with Eibar is, you know, like you say, they're one of the minnows of the league, but they're one of the more interesting minnows. Their story was, you know, it had a little bit of everything. They needed to raise some money. They were completely tiny. They were winning promotion with the smallest budget in the second division. They weren't just a small side. They were the most interesting small side, you know, probably in European football. So I got interested in them. I'd always had a sort of lookout for Eibar results because they've got this connection with Scottish football based on the Escocia La Brava fan group. So they come over to Scotland once a year if they can, and fans from Scotland go back there. So I'd always had this looking out for Eibar and their results, and when they got promoted to La Liga, I thought this would be great if there was a book on this, and there wasn't, so why not write it myself?
Now, I've got to say, the draw this week has already made it onto, of course, the very sophisticated pages of Wikipedia as going down in infamy as one of their greatest moments. As a man that's followed the club and knows a lot about the club, obviously, would you say this is a historic turning point for the side, as some people have already called it?
I think so. I mean, the best result until this point was probably the 1-0 they got over Valencia a few weeks ago. Until then, that was the biggest team they'd ever. I mean, Valencia are, you know, the third biggest supported, fourth biggest supported, you know, it depends who you ask, team in Spain. And they beat them 1-0 just a few weeks ago. They then drew with Sevilla with 9 men as well. So they've got quite a few good results under their belt already this season. And by the end of the season, you know, you would hope that the Real Madrid one isn't even the main one of their 2016-17 season.
Now, why should people have a bit more attention towards Eibar as a side in general before we dive into a little bit more of the tactics behind what went on the weekend? Why should this side? It's been, as we mentioned, quite an incredible rise, especially in the last 10 years, from Segunda B division up into the top flight. They were very lucky to stay in the top flight, though, after their first season finishing 18th and then being reinstated back into the Liga after Elche's, shall we say, mismanagement of the club knocked them back down into the second division and out of the top flight. Is it a side, though, that you think has room to grow? And Pat, obviously, it's probably not going to be a club that will ever really draw attention into the top four or so. But is it a side that we can see realistically making steps towards that top eight, maybe looking towards possibly a Europa League spot, something like that?
Yeah, well, I mean, they're definitely making steps towards that top eight. Whether they ever get there is another matter. But since they've come up to the top division, they've been one of the more sensibly run teams. They've kept money aside each year. They haven't used all of the income, which for them was a massive increase in income. They were going from just a couple of million budget for the whole season to the first season they were up, it was about 16 million euros. And now with the new TV deal coming in, the budget's gone up even more, and it's expected to hit 40 million euros this season.
I was just going to jump in as well. Yeah. I think what I like about Eibar, because I've been there as well, is it's the community spirit. They're one of the only clubs, I think, in like one of the big European leagues that are very defined by their community. You know, yes, they're a small club, but I think the ground in Peru is going to have 12,000 seats once the new work's done. But they are very much, I mean, they haven't lost whatever it is they had many years ago. Even though they're now in with the big boys, they still retain that charm almost.
No, you're quite right, yeah.
Does that have an ability to stay, though?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, this season the fans are already a little bit upset because with the building of the stadium, building it up a little bit, they've had to knock down the old East Goal, which was where the main fan group would, you know, stand and shout and sing and dance and everything throughout the game. But they've had to knock that down to rebuild it and make a bigger version. So now the fan group are stuck in a little corner on a temporary stand, and it's just not the same, and they're a little bit annoyed about it because, you know, a lot of the people are now, but they are realistic and they know they're only going to have 5, maybe 6, 7 years in the top flight, if they're lucky. So they don't really want to spend those top years in a sort of makeshift stadium. You know, they're going to have this fantastic stadium for, you know, the day that they do eventually get relegated. So, but it's not really the club's fault. It's La Liga, or, you know, stipulating all these rules, and there's no need for them to have a stadium of 12,000 seats. I mean, the stadium, the capacity when they got promoted was 5,000. Even that, they struggled to fill. The season they got promoted, their like total attendance for 21 home games was 63,000, which, when you consider that Ronaldo managed to bring like 80,000, I think it was, to the Bernabeu for his presentation, that was more than Eibar got for a whole season of second division football when they were playing well. This was the year they won promotion. In other years, it was even smaller.
Ewan, do you think there'll ever be a year when they'll perhaps go outside of their budget? Because, again, when I interviewed their president, that was one of the things I got from Alex Aranadabal, was that they never wanted to sort of spend outside of their means. And I think going forward, if they want to improve, and as you've just explained there, maybe they don't. Maybe they, you know, this next sort of period is their golden era, and then they'll go back to where they were before. But do you think it's likely that they, you know, they might decide, let's just really go for it for 2 or 3 seasons, we'll sort of speculate to accumulate almost?
Yeah, well, that's always a temptation. And Alex Aranzabal is no longer there. They've now got Amaya Gorostiza. She's in charge now. And, you know, she's been keeping the same sort of philosophy. That's why she was voted in the first place. But if she goes, you don't know who comes after or who comes after that. And eventually there might be a new board of directors at the club that have a slightly different view on things. And, you know, when you spend, you know, a few months in the relegation zone and it comes up to the January transfer window, there is always that temptation to spend a little bit extra out with your means just to stay up. And that's when you hit problems. And Eibar has always been a team that spends what they can, and just whatever results they get, whether success or failure, they'll take that. But once you've been in, you know, the Bernabeu, and you've been to the Camp Nou and all these fantastic stadiums, there's a temptation to do whatever you can to hold on to it. And that's, I think, where some clubs in the past have hit trouble. You saw Xerez that came up, I think, 5 or 6 years ago. They had one season in La Liga, went down, tried to, you know, throw money at promotion, a bounce back promotion, and they just fell through the divisions. They're in, I think, the 5th or 6th tier now.
Is that attitude you mentioned, not getting too carried away, is that something that you think that José Luis Mendilibar as well has, understands, and tries to use, just the kind of not getting carried away sort of attitude? He's immediately come out after the draw this weekend and said, look, we need to recognise and make sure everybody understands that we are still not anywhere near the likes of Real Madrid. This is a great result, but this doesn't mean that we're taking steps to become that good consistently. And very much seems to have a very level head. And do you think that was one of the reasons for bringing him in last season? Because he's a manager that understands the Eibar attitude?
Yeah, I think exactly. It reminds me a lot of Claudio Ranieri when he comes out with these comments, just, you know, get to the 40 points, secure relegation, and then after that, just enjoy yourself. And there's not that many managers that are going to be quite as realistic as that. So, yeah, I mean, he'd been at Eibar before when they were back in the second division. So he knows the setup there. He knows just how modest a club it was. He knew what he was getting into, to put it another way. So, yeah, I think he was brought in for that kind of reason. Someone with a level head that's going to try and get relegation. And then if you secure that, then have some fun. But there's no need to set any wild expectations. And after a draw at the Bernabeu, it'd be all too easy to, you know, change the goal for the season. But there's no chance that he's going to get too carried away by one result.
An incredible result that it was, the 1-1 draw, and taking the lead early on had to be saved, Real Madrid, by Gareth Bale in the 17th minute, and then Eibar resisting and holding off against Real Madrid as they pressed forward. There's been a lot of debate about Real's approach to that game. Do you think that played into the away side's hands slightly, the fact that Madrid don't seem to be able to create anything down the centre, using the flanks a lot. It allows teams to just smother that heart of the pitch, and we've seen the likes of Atleti do it very well against Barcelona on time to time, when you're limited to just being able to put balls into the flanks when the heart of the pitch just doesn't have any room to work into. And that's easier to defend and clear away, it seems, for some sides. Do you think Madrid played into Eibar's hands a touch in trying to find a winner after finding parity early on in that game?
I'm not too sure. I mean, a lot of people are criticising Zidane for his selection. He rested Sergio Ramos, and you know that's fair enough. But I think the main absence for Real Madrid, the two absences were Casemiro and Luka Modric, and obviously he had no control over that. You could really tell they were missing. Eibar were quite comfortable in midfield. When Real Madrid started attacking with Ronaldo and Bale down the wings, there was always a chance that something could happen. But the two fullbacks played really well for Eibar, especially Ander Kappa. I thought he was fantastic. And what was most interesting to me was that probably Eibar's two best players were Ander Kappa at right back and Dani Garcia in the centre park, who are the only two players still on the squad that have been there since the promotion season all the way to now. There's Hotta still there as well, but he went away and he came back. So they've managed to stifle Real Madrid with, you know, two guys that have been there all along. But I wouldn't criticise Madrid's approach too much, because I think they weren't helped by Modric and Casemiro being absent.
There was quite a bit more intensity, I thought, from Eibar as well, and I think that's possible. I think Zidane's actually come out sort of late this afternoon and said much the same, that he wasn't overly impressed with Madrid's attitude. And Eibar did actually have more tackles than Madrid during the game. The statistic that struck me, and it's incredible, Benzema had only 6 touches in the game before he was replaced. I mean, when has that ever happened before? And I think, you know, we've sort of suggested before with other teams is that when you get, and we say this respectfully, the minnows of the league are coming to these grounds, whether, you know, mentally some players switch off. They think it's going to be an easy win. And just by doing that before the game, obviously Eibar taking the lead, and then once Bale had equalised, I mean, I thought Eibar was sort of reasonably comfortable for a lot of that game.
Yeah, they passed it about really well. There were points where it would go almost a full minute without Real Madrid getting the ball. It wasn't just, you know, win the tackle and then, you know, hit it all the way up the park. Eibar, when they got the ball, they would pass it back, pass it around the centre-backs a little bit and then try to make something happen. They when they won the ball, which wasn't, you know, it wasn't too frequently, when they did have it, they managed to keep it for at least, you know, half a minute before they gave it back.
Do you think, gents, it's almost patronising to say to Eibar, this is one of your best results that you will ever have? It's a day that the players will always remember, going to the Bernabeu and getting a point. It certainly is a fantastic result, but the way in which some places have treated this result, it seems like the blame is obviously going on Madrid's shoulders. It's a game they should have won. Everyone will feel they should have won. Not enough credit is being passed on to Eibar for their performance. And the patronising nature of these statements, we should be crediting any La Liga side that can go to the Bernabeu and get a result, but we shouldn't be saying it's because they got lucky, or obviously Madrid had a slight off day, but we should be crediting them more for this, don't you think?
I would agree with that, but I would also add that when Villarreal and Las Palmas took a point off of Real Madrid, it was the same case, and it'll always be the same case with anyone taking a point, with, you know, Celta Vigo on the weekend and all kinds of stuff. The focus, although as much as that's wrong in a sense, and we've just addressed that there, like Eibar are an attacking team, and as Ewan says, they were pretty comfortable for large parts, but the natural sense is to always think who lost the game as opposed to who won it. And Real Madrid lost 2 points and Eibar won a point based on what you'd imagine would happen.
And if you look at it as well, you know, Isco was poor, Kovacic was poor. By the end of it, you know, Cruz was absolutely shattered, having to get through the work that perhaps Modric would have done. The flip side of that, Pedro Leon was absolutely superb. But again, the focus will be on how badly certain players played for Madrid rather than how well Eibar did. And I agree completely that, you know, really the credit should be going to Eibar.
What about then, before we wrap up this part of the show, what about the pressure on Zidane? Continuing with these draws, a frustrating draw, of course, that we've touched on in the Champions League in midweek. Frustrating again this weekend. And a man who relieved that pressure off himself last season and started so well, and, you know, being likened to Pep Guardiola one week, and now he's been likened to Rafa Benitez, a man who doesn't have enough options attacking wise. He doesn't get the creative best down the heart of the pitch suddenly. This criticism is flying in on Zidane. Plenty of pressure on the Real Madrid manager, but enough pressure for him to be worried in his hot seat in the dugout.
Can you really be under pressure when you're unbeaten? Seriously?
Well, apparently so. Considering the amount of flack that he's getting for the last four games or so with these draws, and particularly the performance this weekend. And you know what the tough situation is at Madrid. If you're not succeeding and excelling, there's going to always be people that will say, well, there's plenty of other managers that would happily step in and take this job. This is a guy, remember, that was potentially going to lose his job if he didn't win the Champions League final last season. That's expectations beyond belief when you've got that riding all over.
But he's also a guy that's had his president back him completely, 100%, and has agreed with the way in which he wants to run the team. So, no, I don't agree with that at all.
I don't think he's under too much pressure, but I would say that there are two things that Zidane brings, and that's the sort of rotation long-term attitude, and also the morale of the group is meant to be really high because he's a player and he knows them, etc., etc. And then in the last couple of weeks, we've seen the morale, certainly in Ronaldo's case, and a couple of other edgings around has dropped a little bit and has shown some inconsistencies. And the rotation policy, I think, has sort of killed any momentum that they've had from wins this season, because you end up having almost completely different team each time. And yeah, in the long term, it may turn out to be true, but in the short term, it's certainly proving to be potentially false as to whether it's the right way to go.
Ewan, finally, with Eibar, expectations for this season, is it just stay safe? Is there any chance of them wanting to push on from their 14th spot finish last season, move themselves up table, mid-table? What's the aim? What's the goal for this side? And do they let themselves get a little bit carried away after the result?
Well, you saw the pictures of them in the jacuzzi. I think they got a little bit carried away on Saturday night, but I'm sure by the time the international break's over, they'll be, you know, right back at it. And yeah, like we were saying, the goal for them this season is avoid relegation, but that doesn't mean they couldn't do better last season. You know, they were in contention for a top half finish and then fell away a little bit at the end, and they've done that both seasons in the top flight. So, you know, they've had a good start. They've beat Valencia. They managed to beat Real Sociedad last week as well, which was big result. They drew with Sevilla, drew with Real Madrid, lots of good results, but it's worth keeping in mind that they've always struggled in the second half of the season, so the more points they can put in the piggy bank just now, the better.
They do take on Osasuna after the international break. Espanyol, Villarreal, Las Palmas are coming up as well. There are a few of the big sides that they're just avoiding until January, when they take on Atletico Madrid and Barcelona. Very difficult start to 2017 for Eibar, but certainly points potentially on the way still after the break. When we come back, we're going to be looking at what all the unsung heroes from the last week or so, some of the other results from around La Liga, and a quick look at the international break that's coming up this weekend as well. All that and more when we return, and a big thanks to Ewan for joining us on the show today. Really appreciate it, mate. We'll be back in just a moment. Yes, welcome back to Eye on La Liga. We are done and dusted with the breakdown of the weekend, or perhaps not, because it's one of my favourite parts of the show. It's time for our guests to give us their unsung heroes and other big games of the week. Jason, I want to go first with you, please. Who should we have been keeping an eye out on, and perhaps keeping an eye on in the future from La Liga after this weekend?
Okay, well, for me, a bit like last week when there was a standout, this week, Wissam Ben Yedder from Sevilla. He was the main man in midweek for the Andalusians. He scored the winner against Lyon in the Champions League. And two more at the weekend. A lot of pressure on his shoulders to fill Kevin Gamero's shoes. But a last-minute winner, I say, to give them the win over Alaves. Bit of a snip for me. 7.65 million, I think he cost. Full of running, full of energy. He's intelligent. He draws defenders. You know, he opens up the spaces behind him well. And I think he makes things a lot easier for people like Sami Nasri and the other players that, you know, are looking to sort of affect the play. So for me, you know, Ben Yedder gets my vote this week.
Yeah, it's not a bad start for his season so far in La Liga. 5 appearances, 3 goals in the league alone. Champions League as well, 1 appearance, 1 goal. Not too bad indeed for the man who came in from Toulouse this season. What about yourself, Mark? Who have you got on the unsung heroes list this week?
Yeah, well, it's anyone who thinks that we pre-plan this show and go through everything religiously before we start, doesn't know how frantically I'm looking for the La Liga score sheet for the weekend now, because as per usual, Jason has gone and nicked my my unsung hero.
Don't show him the notes beforehand. That's all you got to do. We do pre-plan and have these massive group meetings, and then Mark just leaves his piece of paper out on the table, I'm sure, and Jason, because this happened last week as well with Jason Steele.
Yeah, no, Balenciaga, we had it as well, now Ben Yedder, so I'm going to have to go with David Garcia of Las Palmas, because it's always interesting when the cameras are off Las Palmas, in a sense. They go away to Osasuna, they're 2-0 down at half-time against a side that most people think they're going to win, and then, you know, you can look at them afterwards, but coming back from 2-0 down and having a 91st-minute equaliser away to a newly promoted side is no mean feat, and it's a good point for them. So David Garcia definitely gets a good mention from me for providing the key moment for his side there. So there's always a couple of unsung heroes around. You've just got to look a bit carefully for them.
Yeah, and an incredible start to the season continues for Las Palmas. And just to mention in the Malaga game against Athletic Bilbao as well, perhaps some of those players not really covering themselves in glory with, I think it was 9 yellow cards for Malaga in that game, all losing their heads a bit after a slightly difficult start to the season. And getting a 2-1 victory, though, against Bilbao, very decent result indeed. Bilbao basically playing Jekyll and Hyde at the moment. 4 wins, 3 losses. You just don't know what you're going to get when they step out onto the surface. Right, let's talk about Spain and the international break coming up. I suggested there was a bit of rest for you guys, but considering the clashes that we've got, and particularly this first clash for Spain in their World Cup qualification group, taking on Italy away from home. Spain against Italy is always a fantastic chess match, particularly in the last 2 major tournaments that we've seen. Spain were very disappointing against the Italians in Euro 2016, of course, in the summer. Are we expecting a little bit of a bounce back? Can we expect too much of the same, though, with 2 different managers at the helm? What are we going to be thinking about this one, Jason? It's by far the best encounter that we've got of the weekend of these international breaks, Spain against Italy.
Yeah, indeed. And I think we're going to see Julen Lopetegui going for it again. I think, as you just said, you know, Spain were very disappointing in what was Vicente Del Bosque's last game. They didn't do themselves any justice whatsoever. And yeah, I think Lopetegui wants to put a stamp on the side, as we said when we spoke about them at the last international break. He's left a few people out that, you know, there's a few question marks there. Juan Mata's been playing very well, but he's not made it into the side. Fabregas, potentially, could this be the end of his international career? Costa's back in business and firing on all cylinders, so I'm very, very excited to see what he does. And one of the picks for me, which it's not surprising, but given his current form, Isco at Real Madrid, he's not really done it at Real in the last few weeks, but Lopetegui's come out and quite clearly said that's his type of player. And, you know, that's the sort of play he wants to see in the Spanish side. That's the sort of style that he brings to the side that he wants these players to play. So, you know, Italy will sit back and defend, as Italy always do. As you say, a chess match. But I think we're going to see a much brighter Spain. Whether it will be enough to take a win, we'll find out.
Yeah, it's, the squad selection has been a touch interesting, as you say, Diego Costa back in as well. And great to see Sergio Rico brought in for the Sevilla goalkeeper. All he has one cap to his name, the 23-year-old, of course. There's going to be plenty of waiting time behind David De Gea, you imagine, for Rico to really get an opportunity in the national team. But interesting squad. What about you, Mike? What about the touch on there from Jason about Cesc Fabregas and perhaps an international career coming to an end, left out again of a Spain squad for a very important game, and a game that could prove pivotal in terms of winning the group in this World Cup qualification?
It's a strange one when you think that Fabregas is a player who hasn't really performed much for Chelsea, but when given the chance, when he's come off the bench, he's actually done quite well. And compared to Isco, you say there, hasn't played well for a good number of months now, and it's a strange situation to find yourself in, that you're saying one player who has had a great career and is highly rated is over, and yet one player opposite him who has had a slightly less great career and is slightly less well rated, he's now back in the frame. So it must be some kind of thinking that Julen Lopetegui has, especially knowing Isco from the under-19s, under-20s, under-21s, must have an impact, that he's trying to build a side and he feels like he can get the best out of Isco. If that works, then great. They go into an Italy side which are kind of in a transition themselves, so they need to get their house in order pretty quickly to avoid losing this one. And especially with the way the World Cup qualifiers always work, you have to finish top of that group. So avoiding defeat in Turin will be an important sign for them. But yeah, for Fabregas, I don't think it's over, because we all know that he can come back and he is a good enough player. For the time being, it must be difficult for him to see a way back.
I just wonder, is he getting to that stage, that age in the career where Fabregas' time is just perhaps done? Our time is just perhaps done here on the podcast. A massive thanks to Jason and to Mark. Jason, just remind everybody of your Twitter handle so we can get people hitting you up and complaining about everything that you say on this show.
Funnily enough, at Jason Pettigrew.
I've still been following you at Jason Pettiford, your alter ego account, but I'll make sure I put Jason Pettigrew in my Twitter account in the next few minutes. So what about yourself, Mark?
Yeah, all my abuse channels are open at that Mark Mayo on Twitter, and also they have a small Facebook page as well with a few things going on. Sadly, none of it's verified, unlike my esteemed colleague, so we'll... We'll hopefully reach that point one day.
The best of us don't have the blue tick, mate. Don't worry about it. The best of us don't have the blue tick. We will be back in about 7-8 days' time or so, looking back at the international break. There'll be plenty of La Liga action to start looking ahead to as well in a week's time. Until then, remember to get on Marker in English on Twitter. That's at Marker in English, at Marker in English. And of course on Marker.com as well, where you can read Mark and Jason and all the top journalists' work from Marker.com as we keep you up to date with all of the breaking Spanish football news, comment and opinion on the website. Until after the international break, have a very good break indeed from the La Liga season. Take a breath. It's been manic in September and it's going to continue right up until the end of the season. Enjoy the slight break while you can. I'll see you next week. Have a good one.